Thank you, Glenn, for this kind introduction. Moldova has recently been in the news more than is usually the case due to some grandiose financial fraudulent affairs. The theft of the equivalent of $1 billion from three banks in Moldova. The amount, $1 billion, is equivalent to 15% of Moldova's annual GDP. As the Economist magazine pointed out, it is a world record. Never was this proportion of a country's annual GDP, 15%, been stolen in one fell swoop. World record. And more recently, there is a great deal of conjecture, speculation, incomplete reporting about the amount, a combined amount of $22 billion being siphoned out of Russia, laundered through Moldovan banks and courts to reach Western banks. I'm not an expert on financial and banking affairs. I frankly don't understand these financial operations, maneuvers, shenanigans, but they are at the top of media coverage of Moldova at the present time. Paradoxically enough, these thefts and these fraudulent financial operations have taken place in a country tightly controlled by one person, by the country's richest businessman, Vladimir Plahotniuc, the only billionaire known to operate in Moldova. He has undertaken what I have called an operation of state capture. By state capture, the phenomenon of state capture denotes the takeover of control over state institutions by political and business interest groups operating untransparently and promoting their own interests by controlling state institutions. State capture is a hallmark of a deinstitutionalization of a state. And this has been the case in Moldova in the last 8 years. It can be precisely dated, and this is another Moldovan paradox, to the assumption of power by the so-called Alliance for European Integration in 2009, which replaced at that time the communist government under President Vladimir Voronin and declared the continuation of Moldova's European course. Moldova is not really a failed state, although many consider it as such. Moldova is an incomplete state before becoming a failed state. It never took shape as a modern European state, unlike Ukraine or unlike Georgia. Moldova, as a weak state, vulnerable state, was ripe for capture. The term oligarchy is frequently used in relation to Moldova. It is a misnomer. Oligarchy, by definition, is a group phenomenon in which a number of players, political and business players, of comparable strength, are dividing political power and the economic spoils of governance among themselves in a constant process of negotiation, renegotiation. It is a self-regulating, self-balancing process, the oligarchy. In Moldova, we do not have a constellation of oligarchs. We have one single individual, Mr. Plahotniuc, who is far wealthier than anyone else in Moldova. There are no comparable players, not remotely. So he has been able, and he is a master operator, politically and financially, to take over control of the state. Power is concentrated in Moldova in one pair of hands. This is not necessarily a bad thing. Power could have been concentrated in the hands of a capable and convinced reformer. Moldova could have had an authoritarian reformist rule on the model of Mikhail Saakashvili in Georgia. But this did not happen in Moldova. There was no talented leader to take over this mission for the country. Instead, when Plahotniuc took over, the state had already been eviscerated by political parties. What Plahotniuc did was to take over an already eviscerated state as a result of the premature introduction in Moldova of the parliamentary system of government through parliamentary parties. For the last 2 years approximately, Plahotniuc has concentrated the following powers in his hands. Parliamentary majority. He controls a composite parliamentary majority comprised of the remnants of about four political parties, which Mr. Plahotniuc broke up and enticed their members of parliament into the new parliamentary majority. This majority comprises about 58 to 60 parliamentary deputies out of 101, barely short of a constitutional majority of 2/3 in the Moldovan parliament. The parliament's chairman, Andrian Candu, is the godson of Mr. Plahotniuc. Mr. Plahotniuc has arrogated to himself the title of coordinator of the parliamentary majority, an unconstitutional position, an extra-legal position, an informal position. But he controls the parliamentary majority from that position. Mr. Plahotniuc's appointees control the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the Prosecutor General's office, and many other prosecutors' offices, key posts in the judiciary, including most of the justices of the Supreme Court, the head of the Chisinau Court of Appeals, several courts of the first instance, which have recently conducted high-profile trials behind closed doors, of which more in due course. Mr. Plahotniuc's personal appointee, Pavel Filip, is the prime minister, and this group also controls key ministries, including economics ministry, justice ministry. Mr. Plahotniuc is the sole owner of 6 television channels with countrywide coverage and 2 radio channels with countrywide coverage. His appointees form the majority on the Audiovisual Council, the regulatory agency for the media market, ensuring Mr. Plahotniuc's almost full control of the airwaves in Moldova. What still escapes Mr. Plahotniuc's control are the ethnic non-Moldovan areas in the country, such as the city of Belzi, second largest city on the right bank of the Dnistru, majority Russian and Ukrainian speaking, Russian speaking majority, Ukrainian majority, but they are Russian speaking Ukrainians. And the Gagauz area. These continue to escape Mr. Plahotniuc's control. This takeover process has been ongoing since 2010. In that year, following the second parliamentary elections that brought the Alliance for European Integration to power, the 3 parties of this coalition divided all state institutions, all of them, among themselves on a political basis, including what should have been the non-political law enforcement agencies and market regulatory agencies, all the ministries, all the state agencies and departments. They are all, without exception, divided up politically among these 3 parties. The European Union covered this up. From 2010 onward, the European Union depicted Moldova as a success story of the success story of the Eastern Partnership. This was, of course, a propaganda move. It had some noble motives on the part of the European Commission. The noble motive was to pull Moldova, despite all its domestic flaws, into the European integration process. This could not have been done it could not have been ratified by the European Parliament and by 28 national parliaments in the European Union if Moldova had the Communist Party in government. So it became a goal of the European Commission at all cost to exclude the Communist Party from government. The Communist Party was at the time by far the strongest in the country. It became necessary to form a parliamentary coalition with any non-communist party or any party that would not carry the title communist, regardless of whether it was democratic or not, pro-Western or not, honest or corrupt. So this was the false political basis on which the European Commission and a good number of European ministers of foreign affairs encouraged the formation of this government and tolerated, actually covered up, the division of government among political parties in the way I mentioned. Within this coalition, the party of Mr. Plahotniuc, called the Democratic Party, was the second largest of the three. But this party, Mr. Plahotniuc especially, they applied the classical salami tactics of the communist-dominated coalitions in Eastern Europe after the Second World War. I'm sure that they did not study that blueprint. These people in government are uneducated. They don't know the history of Eastern Central Europe. Their horizon is very provincial, limited to the Russian-speaking media universe. They did not copy the communist salami tactics from the early post-World War II period. They did it on their own, in a very creative way. Between 2010 and 2016, Mr. Plahotniuc's party sliced the coalition little by little, every year, acquiring new positions of power in government. The key to this was the control of law enforcement agencies, starting with the Prosecutor General's office. Moldova has become what is called a compromat state, in which law enforcement agencies stockpile compromat about everybody, both the opponents and the allies of the government. And the compromat can be selectively released at a time of the authorities choosing to either blackmail or induce, incentivize various political and business players to submit to the authorities. Very often, merely the threat of releasing compromat is enough to either subdue or incentivize somebody in business or in politics to do what the government wants that player to do. And the apex of the compromat state is the General Prosecutor's Office with the subordinate prosecution offices. All these law enforcement institutions came under the control of the Mr. Plahotniuc's party in the distribution of posts in 2010. And he has been using this with to great effect to remove or subdue his opponents and to recruit new allies. This explains the enormous expansion of Mr. Plahotniuc's informal power since then. During this time, Mr. Plahotniuc occupied insignificant political posts, for example, vice chairman of parliament, vice chairman of his own party, or no political posts at all. In the last 2 years, he has assumed the title of coordinator of the parliamentary majority. Mr. Plahotniuc maintains a number of partnerships with which he juggles in the air like a juggler holding several balls in the air at the same time. Mr. Plahotniuc does not have allies. He has situational partners. He was initially an ally of President Voronin. He left President Voronin and his Communist Party. He made an alliance with the strongest pro-European, pro-Western, pro-Atlantic party in Moldova, Vlad Filat's Liberal Democratic Party. He destroyed that party and jailed Vlad Filat. He is now in a situational partnership with the Socialist Party of the recently elected president Igor Dodon. He was in the recent past an ally of the financial operator Vyacheslav Platon, with which for a period they conducted joint financial operations. Only now Mr. Platon is in jail in Moldova. So Mr. Plahotniuc's road to supreme power is strewn with the political corpses of his temporary allies. But Mr. Plahotniuc has external partnerships as well with the European Union. The EU has been quite generous to Moldova. It has disbursed a total of more than 700 million euros to Moldova since the pro-European government came to power, with an additional 100 million this year. In return for this, Mr. Plahotniuc and his government promised to maintain a pro-Europe course and reforms. However, the European Union itself is the foremost critic of the lack of reforms in Moldova. European Union assistance at this time is confined to budget support, essentially amounting to humanitarian assistance, enabling Moldova to meet the budget expenditure targets, without which social spending would completely collapse. With the United States, Mr. Plahotniuc has had a circumstantial partnership. The US, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2014, the US prioritized stability in Moldova, stability at all costs, regardless of whether reforms are conducted, regardless of whether the system is democratic, stability in the rear of Ukraine. This has been the US policy watchword since the Russian invasion in Ukraine. Mr. Plahotniuc does promise stability, his own kind of stability. And with Russia, Mr. Plahotniuc has a significant situational partnership by making possible, ensuring the election of the pro-Russia Socialist Party candidate Igor Dodon as president. It was Mr. Plahotniuc's media that put Mr. Dodon over the top with only 52% in the recent presidential election. Moldova had been for many years a state of what I described as procedural democracy. For many years, between 1994 and 2014, elections were procedurally correct. They were free and fair. They were certified as free and fair by international authorities. The governments were accepted as fully legitimate. This became possible, ironically, due to the extremely high number of Soviet nostalgic and pro-Russia voters who ensured that pro-Russia or Soviet nostalgic parties took first place in the elections at all times. The Communist Party was re-legalized in 1996. Having been banned in 1991, was re-legalized in 1996. All the elections from 1998 till 2010 saw the Communist Party taking a distant first place and forming stable parliamentary majorities. In 2004, President Voronin, the leader of the Communist Party, shifted gears. He proclaimed a European orientation from above. And this was a precondition for communist voters to accept this shift, because it came from the leader of the Communist Party, whom a plurality of voters trusted. Of course, the pro-European segments of the electorate endorsed this course while being highly skeptical about Voronin. But Voronin's launching the European orientation, signing the first partnership agreement with the European Union, ensured that this would be accepted by the majority of the population. The Communist Party, of course, had run for office on a Soviet nostalgic platform, but it did this trick on its own voters, because in Mr. Voronin's mind, around 2005, the West was winning, Russia was a losing power, it had just lost the fight in Ukraine. So Mr. Voronin bandwagoned with what he regarded at that time as the winning West. But the international situation changed after the European Union faced multiple crises starting in 2008. The popularity of the European Union in Moldova correspondingly declined. If in Voronin's time 70% of the population favored the European course as it interpreted it from Voronin's mouth, while 30% opposed it, by now the proportions are almost the reverse. This is the result of a number of factors. The first is the undeniable crisis in the European Union, the loss of popularity of the European Union, even among many Western voters. This could not have failed to have repercussions in Moldova. But in Moldova, there is a specific factor of Russian television. Russian television blankets Moldova. Moldova does not have any kind of informational security. Russian television is widely watched, and Russian propaganda is accepted by a growing number of voters disenchanted with the governments that ruled under the European label. The terms democracy and the terms European integration are discredited as a result. No political party could win elections in Moldova with the watchwords of democracy or European integration. Mr. Putin is consistently, in the last few years, by far the most popular politician in Moldova, more than 60% positive rating, compared to Angela Merkel or Barack Obama at 30%, 25% in the Moldovan voters' ratings. And domestically, the politician that now enjoys the highest rating is Igor Dodon, the leader of the Socialist Party. 2014 saw the end of what I regarded as procedural democracy in Moldova. The election was manipulated by Mr. Plahotniuc's power apparatus. It was the first election that his power apparatus was able to manipulate, and it ensured a transfer of voters from the Communist Party of Mr. Voronin to the Socialist Party of Mr. Dodon. The Socialist Party has inherited most of the communist electorate, but it is also inheriting or absorbing a growing number of the voters from Mr. Plahotniuc's own Democratic Party. That party is discredited. It runs in the single digits in the opinion polls. The original rationale of Mr. Plahotniuc's party was to propose an equidistant course for Moldova between the European Union and Russia. It was a Eurosceptical party, and it was a Moldovanist party as opposed to a Romanianist party. Now, voters who did cast their ballots for this party now find more persuasive reasons to switch over to Mr. Dodon, who is even more Moldovanist as opposed to Romanianist, and who is even more Eurosceptic compared to Mr. Plahotniuc's party. The recent presidential election in December 2016, saw first, even before the first round, the withdrawal from the race of Mr. Plahotniuc's party's candidate, the former chairman of parliament, Marian Lupu. He ran so low in the polls that in order to withdraw embarrassment, to avoid an embarrassment, he withdrew before the first round. The second round witnessed an enormous surprise. The candidate of the pro-Western opposition, Maia Sandu, who ran with the support of three pro-Western political parties, made an extremely strong race despite an almost complete lack of financing and of access to television. The secret, perhaps, of her success was she focused on the issue of governmental corruption and on attacking Mr. Plahotniuc personally. This resonated to voters a great deal. Corruption has become a nearly national obsession in Moldova. It is so widespread at all levels, but especially at high governmental levels. And Mr. Plahotniuc, as I mentioned earlier, has a 90% negative rating. That's the difference between the approval rate and the disapproval rate. So despite lack of resources, despite lack of access to the media, Maia Sandu made an extremely strong race. She finished in the runoff against Mr. Dodon with 48% versus Dodon's 52%, almost a miracle. But what put Mr. Dodon over the top was the television channels from Mr. Plahotniuc's media holding. Because every day of the campaign, they broadcast slanderous and often obscene material against Maia Sandu. Had it not been for this factor, she would have won, she would have scored an enormous upset against Mr. Dodon's pro-Russia platform. Anti-corruption and anti-oligarch, in quotation mark, slogans proved more effective than Mr. Dodon's pro-Russia platform. Mr. Plahotniuc, however, decided that Mr. Dodon would be a far more accommodating president than Maia Sandu would have been, and her allies, than Maia Sandu and her allies in her coalition would have been. At present, Mr. Plahotniuc's media holding has orchestrated the following political configuration of the country, in the country. On one side, an outspokenly pro-Russia president, Igor Dodon, with very limited constitutional powers, and those powers that he does have under the constitution are being circumscribed and contained through informal means by Mr. Plahotniuc. So Mr. Plahotniuc is setting himself up as the guardian of Moldova against Russian influence via Mr. Dodon, on the one hand. On the other hand, the governing system, I call it a system because it's an amorphous coalition of many factions in parliament, the governing system, which presents itself as pro-European without being recognized as such by the European Union. So a constant struggle between the pro-Russia orientation and, in quotation marks, pro-Europe orientation is being staged every day in the Moldovan political arena, with Mr. Plahotniuc presenting himself in the West and in Romania as the guardian of Moldova's independence vis-a-vis Russia, as the protector of the pro-Europe course. At the same time, Mr. Plahotniuc has a tactical or circumstantial partnership with Mr. Dodon, which can be seen almost at every step. For example, last year, Parliament passed legislation to prolong Mr. Plahotniuc's broadcast licenses to the six television channels and two radio channels by another 4 years, from 2018 until 2022. This passed thanks to the socialist votes in parliament, thanks to Mr. Plahotniuc's votes in parliament. In return, Plahotniuc controlled Audiovisual Council, the media market regulatory agency, awarded the Socialist Party two channels of its own, including one channel that had been taken over from a pro-European broadcaster, Mr. Luczynski Jr. In January, Mr. Dodon was in Moscow, and on Mr. Plahotniuc's behalf agreed with the Gazprom leadership to appoint a candidate nominated by Mr. Plahotniuc to be the head of Gazprom Moldova, a company in which Gazprom has 51% of the shares. In return for this, Mr. Dodon got to appoint the head of the gas supply company for the city of Chisinau. So these are instances of the informal, limited, circumstantial partnership between Mr. Plahotniuc and Mr. Dodon. But the biggest evidence, of course, is the fact that Mr. Plahotniuc did get Mr. Dodon elected as president. Mr. Plahotniuc has no access to Russia, not at all. He has not quarreled with Russia, but has no access, largely because he does not hold any official state post. He is trying to obtain access to the Kremlin via Mr. Dodon and to obtain concessions that the Moldovan government on its own behalf is unable to obtain from Russia. And this brings me to the subject of Russian influence and Russian leverage in Moldova. The instruments of influence are multiple and diverse. And the issues where Chisinau is not making headway with Moscow in bilateral negotiations, Mr. Plahotniuc is trying to achieve progress via Mr. Dodon. And this includes, for example, the situation of Moldovan gastarbeiters in Russia. Remittances from those gastarbeiters are crucial to Moldova's balance of payments. Moldova would go bankrupt without remittances of its gastarbeiters from Russia. An estimated 500,000 Moldovans work in Russia. Of those, more than 200,000 are estimated to be in violation of Russian immigration and labor laws and need their situation to be regularized. Another estimated 70,000 are in Moldova with interdiction to return to Russia for work. So what Mr. Dodon did in Moscow during his visits in January and in March was to obtain a legal amnesty for Moldovan gastarbeiters as a favor from Mr. Putin to Mr. Dodon, not as a favor to the Moldovan government, but as a favor to the pro-Russia president. Of course, this is in the interest of the government. It is also in the interest of Mr. Dodon to demonstrate to his voters and to undecided voters that he can get things done with Putin. And indeed, Mr. Putin has promised and is in fact enacting a partial amnesty that would affect at least 100,000, probably more, of Moldovan gastarbeiters who are in violation of Russian immigration and labor laws. Market access. Starting in 2006, Russia introduced embargoes on Moldova's main traditional export products to Russia. The embargoes were lifted and reimposed until 2014 several times. Finally, in 2014, Russia imposed a massive embargo, which is for the most part still in place. Again, the government is interested in reopening access to the Russian market for Moldovan producers. The government cannot obtain this in its own right. It is relying on Mr. Dodon to do so. Mr. Dodon has obtained some concessions from Mr. Putin in driblets. Russian authorities, obviously with political authorization, Russian regulatory agencies are allowing individual Moldovan farms, individual Moldovan vineyards to regain access to the Russian market. In driblets, as I mentioned earlier, and always with a saber of Damocles over their head, that the interdictions may be reimposed. And about half of these companies that are allowed to return to the Russian markets are located in Transnistria and in the Gagauz-inhabited region. Again, a modest success for the government. It can win a few more votes. A big success for Mr. Dodonin can win even more votes by demonstrating that he can patch up relations with Russia, where the government cannot do so. Natural gas. Price is no longer a contentious issue because of the fall of the gas prices on international markets. The price of Russian gas delivered to Moldova is now $190 per 1,000 cubic meters. Reasonable, more than reasonable. The issue is not price, it is debts. Moldova, on paper, owns $6.5 billion to Gazprom for past deliveries of Russian gas, a debt that Gazprom never attempted to collect. To no audible protest from Gazprom's shareholders, who obviously are the losers in this scheme. Of the $6.5 million, more than five and a half million, are owned by Transnistria. Less than $1 billion, about $800 million, are owed by the right bank of the Dniester, that is by the Moldovan government. But the Russian government insists on billing the central government of Moldova for the entire bill, on a logic that Russia is also losing in Donbass. If you want Moldova to have your territorial integrity recognized, then you should pay Transnistria's bills. Otherwise, you don't recognize your own territorial integrity. You recognize the logic applied by Russia in Donbass since 2014. So the issue is in suspension. Mr. Dodon and some elements in the Moldovan government propose to extinguish part of the debt, or Chisinau's part of the debt, by turning over to Gazprom in full ownership the internal gas distribution pipelines of Moldova. In Moldova, there is a trunk pipeline that runs from Russia via Ukraine to the Balkans. It's a very big pipeline. It has a capacity of 25 BCM per year, and it actually carries about 22 BCM per year. It supplies Bulgaria, Greece, and Turkey, and Macedonia. But apart from this trunk pipeline, there is, of course, the Moldovan internal distribution gas pipeline. If Gazprom gets its way, and if internal distribution pipelines are turned over into Gazprom's ownership to extinguish the arrears for past deliveries of gas, then Gazprom would control the internal distribution system, and that means that the planned pipeline from Romania into Moldova that would run from the Romanian-Moldovan border to Chisinau could only get to Chisinau but not further, because it would have to use Gazprom-owned distribution pipelines to distribute non-Russian gas in the country. So this is another danger point, and an instrument of Russian influence, obviously. Russian television, I mentioned earlier, Russian television has a devastating impact on Moldova. It is anti-Western, it propagates the Russian world, it slanders the European Union, it stirs up hysteria against NATO. And it finds a naive, credulous audience. The Orthodox Church. Moldova is a 99% Orthodox country. And the great majority of parishes in Moldova, as well as the entire hierarchy, the metropolitanate and the two bishoprics, are part of the Russian Orthodox Church. There is no groundswell of opinion in Moldova to break away from the Russian Orthodox Church. The hierarchy of the Moldovan / Russian Orthodox Church in Moldova is an obscurantist one, is aggressive and anti-European and pro-Putin. The church is factionalized. One particular bishop, the bishop of the city of Belzi, the second largest city on the right bank of the Dnistru River, is in rebellion against the metropolitan in Chisinau. The rebellious archbishop is the most active, the most vocal, the most pro-Russian world, the most pro-Putin, and the most anti-Western. He has had an impact on the election. The metropolitan, Vladimir in Chisinau, he used to have a deal with the Moldovan government when Vlad Filat was prime minister. And he allowed himself, not unlike the Georgian Catholicos some years ago, he kept basically quiet. But since Vlad Filat disappeared as a politician and the deal with the government collapsed, the metropolitan is outspokenly pro-Dodon, endorses Dodon politically and in every possible way. So this is a major instrument of Russian influence in Moldova. But perhaps the most resilient and the most durable instrument is the so-called Russian-speaking population, in which the Russians are not the largest group. They are second largest to Ukrainians. But most Ukrainians in Moldova are linguistically Russified and behave politically as Russians. In the elections of 2014, President Poroshenko made an appeal to Ukrainians in Moldova to vote for the pro-European parties. Poroshenko even traveled to Chisinau to make this appeal from Chisinau. Instead, the great majority of the Ukrainian vote, which is actually a Russian-speaking, quotation marks, vote, went to Mr. Dodon's Socialist Party. And in addition, there is the Gagauz group, and there is a district, the Taraklia district, which has a Bulgarian majority. And there, the sentiments of Sovietophilia, Russophilia, there is no clear distinction there between Sovietophilia and Russophilia, prevail, are deeply entrenched, and these are potential flashpoints in Moldova. Meanwhile, there is a growth, noticeable growth, in Romanian influence. This is a brand new phenomenon. The Russian instruments that I mentioned, that I listed a moment ago, are not new for the most part. They have been there for the last 20 plus years. Romanian influence, however, is noticeably growing, and this is a new development. To some extent, it is a question of generational change. Many Moldovan students who studied in Romania and returned to Moldova regard themselves as Romanian, no longer as Moldovan. Moldova's trade with Romania is growing rapidly. It consists in large measure of semi-finished food products exported in that form from Moldova to Romania, which turns them into finished products, packages them in an attractive way, and exports them to third countries. So this is the main content of Moldovan-Romanian trade, which is growing rapidly. With corruption being, as I mentioned earlier, practically a national obsession in Romania, in Moldova, many Moldovans are impressed by Romania's progress in cracking down on Romanian corruption. Romania used to be a proverbially corrupt country, but it has made enormous strides in combating corruption, not eradicating it. Because corruption in Romania is like the dragon in the story. You slash a few heads and a few more heads grow instead. But the anti-corruption fight is highly effective in Romania. It is supported not only politically, but also operationally in some ways by the US Embassy in Romania. And this makes a strong impression across the border in Moldova. Romania, for the first time, has a budget surplus. For the first time in its post-communist history, has strong economic growth, about 4%, and a budget surplus, from which it has been able to grant a credit, reimbursable credit, of $160 million last year, to be disbursed in four tranches. This, too, adds up to leverage.
Romania's developed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Romania has established a few points of support in the Moldovan political and institutional system. Few, but important, mainly due to personal connections with certain officials. And that concerns, first of all, the Constitutional Court. The justices are allies of Mr. Plahotniuc. There are five justices. One seat is unoccupied, so there are five justices at the moment. Most of them are politically allied to Mr. Plahotniuc, but most of them, all but one, are citizens of Romania and sympathizers of Romania. So this is a sort of forward post, if you will, of Romania in the heart of Moldova's institutional system. And for his part, Mr. Plahotniuc has made his typical situational tactical arrangement with Romania. He allows an unprecedented room for the unification with Romania movement to grow in Moldova. This did not used to be possible until about 2014. Now it is possible. This movement, weak as it is weak. We should distinguish between the Romanian identity question and the Romanian political unification movement. These are two different things, overlapping, but different. While there is growth in the Romanian identity movement, there is also some growth in the pro-unification sentiment. Traditionally, this sentiment ran at about 10%. Now it's edging toward 20%. Still a minority, very much a minority. But the tendency is toward growth. And Mr. Plahotniuc is allowing unprecedented scope for pro-union groups to stage public events and to disseminate their message via media, including some websites controlled by Mr. Plahotniuc. Romania is aspiring, for the first time, to privatize some portions of state property in Moldova. It never happened before. Romania now aspires to it, which, of course, would be preferable to Russian privatization, infinitely preferable. At the same time, there is no clear pro-Romania or pro-unification political party in Moldova. There was one. It was called the Liberal Party. It was a member of the so-called Alliance for European Integration from 2009 until 2016. Now it's part of Mr. Plahotniuc's majority. But this party has become so discredited by its association, close association, with Mr. Plahotniuc, that it now runs at 1%, 2% in the polls and has no chance of getting into the new parliament. So there is a vacuum there. And there are about three or four pro-Romanian unionist parties, small, running in single digits, maybe even below 1%, who aspire to fill that vacuum which remains unfilled. European Union influence. The Moldovan government is highly dependent on European Union financing. But while the financing was oriented between 2009 and 2014, 15, was 15, was oriented mainly toward development aid and toward state capacity building. Those two orientations have been lost after the financial scandals. Instead, the European Union provides budget support, essentially humanitarian assistance, not development, and some capacity building assistance, yes, some capacity building assistance, and budget support mainly for humanitarian purposes, demanding instead reforms. Reforms are not being implemented. The European Union is the first instance to recognize that reforms are not being implemented. But the EU, just like the United States, does not want a collapse of Moldova, social chaos, and repercussions from Russia, repercussions in terms of Ukraine. Stability in the rear of Ukraine is an imperative that continues to prevail. What does pass for reforms? Mostly the reforms that are very elementary, that are demanded by the International Monetary Fund, namely austerity programs, raising the pension age, slashing social benefits to practically zero, reducing the size of government, and instituting bank oversight to prevent any more raiding operations or laundering operations. And this the Moldovan government has delivered. I would not call this structural reforms. I would not call this a part of a European or pro-Western course. These are very elementary measures, which the Moldovan government is delivering. And as a result, IMF financing has been unlocked for the time being at very modest levels. American influence. Up until 2004-2005, the United States played a very active role in Moldova's domestic politics and in trying to shape Moldova's foreign policy. After 2004-2005, the United States itself, beset by the multiple challenges that we all know in various parts of the world, downgraded Moldova as a priority and delegated to the European Union the leading role in Moldova, with the United States taking a back seat, with the position that anything that the European Union did, the United States would support. So the US yielded the initiative to the European Union. This changed abruptly in 2014. By 2014, the much heralded Moldovan success story of the European Union was becoming rapidly discredited. The European Union recoiled in horror at what was happening in Moldova under a European imprint and took a wait-and-see and passive position. Instead, the United States cast, or rather reduced, its policy toward Moldova to the Ukrainian, to the broader Ukrainian context. Stability in the rear of Ukraine. The US reduced its policy toward Moldova to this imperative. And as a result, the US State Department endorsed Mr. Plahotniuk's personal rule in the name of stability. There are several public statements from the State Department, with Victoria Nuland in the lead. She was the main public spokesperson for this policy. We want stability in Moldova. Mr. Plahotniuk brings stability. This attitude on the part of the State Department shocked the pro-Western groups in Moldova. Stability has become almost a derogatory term regarding the US policy toward Moldova and toward Mr. Plahotniuk specifically. The word stability is being used in pejorative quotation marks by pro-Western circles in Moldova. And finally, this brings me to lead off from US policy toward Moldova. It brings us to the Transnistria question. As you know, it is the conflict, the so-called frozen conflict of the longest duration. in former Soviet-ruled territories. The conflict is deeply frozen in the literal sense of the term. There are no negotiations to speak of for a political settlement in Transnistria, nor for the withdrawal of Russian troops, which are there in violation of Moldovan law and of international law since 1991. In 2015, the United States decided to promote what the State Department regard and the White House regarded as a political settlement in Ukraine's Donbas with Russia. And in that context, it started promoting a special negotiations toward a special status for Transnistria in Moldova. Special status for the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics is the political recipe, or was under the Obama administration, the political recipe for a would-be political settlement with Russia in Ukraine's east. US diplomacy began treating the question of Transnistria special status and of Donbas special status in one package. Mere negotiation toward a special status for Transnistria and Moldova, not agreement on a special status, but mere negotiation toward a special status, could have generated pressure on Ukraine to do the same, to make the same concessions, could have become a precedent-setting case, recyclable or reusable against Ukraine in Donbas. This explains the sudden anxiety of the United States and of the German government, both, in 2015-2016, to make visible progress toward a special status for Transnistria in Moldova. It would have become the precedent setter for, or rather against, Ukraine. In both places, Donbas and Transnistria, the pressure was on Kiev and on Chisinau to negotiate this would-be political solution with Russian troops remaining in place and without conditioning the political special status upon the withdrawal of Russian troops from the two territories. It would have been negotiated with Russian troops in place in both cases. No Western, US or European or German diplomat could tell me in many conversations what would happen to the Russian troops in Transnistria or for that matter in Donbas if Chisinau or for that matter Kiev consent to awarding a special status to the representatives of the two territories. And those representatives are not of the two territories, are of Russia. The special status would have inserted those representatives from Tiraspol and from Donbas into Ukraine's or Moldova's political systems with decision-making powers, potentially with blocking powers. Moreover, a special status for Transnistria in Moldova could result, could trigger a chain reaction in other parts of Moldova. The leadership of the Gagauz inhabited territory has already announced, both the previous and the current leadership have both announced that in the event that Transnistria receives a special status, Gagauzia would apply for upgrading its own existing autonomous status to the same level as Transnistria's. The Moldovan parliament, incidentally at the behest of Mr. Plahotniuc's party, has adopted in the first reading a special status for the Bulgarian inhabited district of Taraklia. And this was done at the behest of Mr. Sergei Stanishev, the Bulgarian chairman of the Socialist Party in the European Parliament, former Bulgarian prime minister of an arch-corrupt pro-Russia government, who requested this favor from Mr. Plahotniuc's party, and it was indeed adopted in the first reading in 2015. Then there is the city of Belzi, second largest on the right bank, Russian-speaking, although most inhabitants are Ukrainians, but it's Russian-speaking. And its current mayor, who has been incidentally parachuted from Russia, a politician named Renato Usatyi, advocates a special status for the city of Belzi because it is a Russian-speaking center. Moldova's electoral map is becoming increasingly complicated, not only because of the ethnic linguistic factor, but also because of what one may call societal factors. A great many villages and small towns in northern Moldova have a Ukrainian component of about one-third of the population, who are Russified and who always vote for pro-Russia parties. Following the 2014 parliamentary elections, the 2015 countrywide local elections, and the 2016 parliamentary elections, the map of Moldova looks in the following way. There is an east-west line that bisects Moldova, dividing it into a northern half, colored red, where the Socialist Party rules supreme, a southern half, colored mostly blue, where Moldovan parties prevail, and within the blue southern half, there is a big island of Gagauz and Bulgarian territories, which is also red. This is a highly fragile situation. And insistence on a special status for anyone of these territories risks triggering a chain reaction. Why a chain reaction? Not only on an ethnic linguistic basis, not only on a societal basis. Oh, by the way, speaking of the societal basis, I mentioned the northern half red and the southern half mostly blue. The northern half is mostly apple-growing country, orchard country. The southern half is mostly wine-growing country. Most people are aware of the Moldovan wine exports to Russia or to other countries. Few people are aware of the equally important export to Russia from the orchards in the northern half of the countries, apples, pears, and other fruit. And the Russian embargo on the orchard part of the country dealt an extremely painful blow to the Moldovan economy in 2014. Paradoxically, there is no backlash in that part of Moldova against Russia. On the contrary, voter behavior indicates that they trust the Dodon Socialist Party to correct this situation. Instead of a backlash against Russia for imposing this economic hardship, the backlash is in favor of Dodon's political party in the expectation that it would correct it. To sum up, Moldova is a fragile country. It is deinstitutionalized. It is held together by the informal party apparatus under the control of Mr. Plahotniuc. This is the only plus in this situation, actually. This informal power apparatus, which consists of police power, court power, law enforcement power, and media power, as well as the networks of patron-client relationships that his party is establishing throughout the country, is what holds the country together. Not the state, not the institutions, not a common national awareness, not common aspirations of the Moldovans. Society is highly fragmented. So we have a deinstitutionalized state held together by one powerful political operator. It is not democracy, it is not European orientation, but at least the country is being held together. And what saves Moldova is the fortuitous geographic factor of not having a common border with Russia. Ukraine shields Moldova from falling directly into Russia's lap. Moldova is incapable of resisting this Russia's power of absorption, had it not been for Ukraine. Recommendations, very hard in this situation. The European Union recognizes tacitly, not publicly, In private conversations, senior European officials recognize this failure. So do European parliamentarians. Romania has a hope of somehow rescuing Moldova by establishing informal contacts in the Moldovan body politic, in the institutions, and with the new rising generation, and for the first time, through some modest Romanian economic instruments. Moldova is a military vacuum. NATO has no presence, no role. NATO is not popular in Moldova. And the present Moldovan government does not have the political guts of trying to establish some kind of security links with NATO. Moldovan army has no combat value. Transnistria's army, which is integrated into Russia's chain of command, is far stronger than Moldova's army. What will happen from now on is anybody's guess. Moldova will have parliamentary elections in 2018. Mr. Plahotniuc is trying to change the electoral system, replacing the electoral system by party lists with a system of single mandate constituencies. According to his proposals, all members of the Moldovan parliament would be elected from single mandate constituencies, which would enable Mr. Plahotniuc to select, designate candidates in various electoral districts, cultivate them, support their electoral campaign. They would run under the label of independent, and then they would coalesce in parliament under the coordinator of the parliamentary majority, Mr. Plahotniuc. He is now the coordinator of a parliamentary majority of parties, but in the event of changing the electoral system, he would become the coordinator of a parliamentary majority of individual deputies. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Vlad. So, first question here. Please identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Sam Kramer, and I'm with the George Washington University. And
I don't hear.
Oh, sorry. My name is Sam Kramer. I'm with the George Washington University. And my question is, since you've just mentioned that the Moldovan parliament is potentially going to be composed of a majority of independents, if Mr. Plahotniuc gets his way, would you say that the system would resemble that of Belarus, where...
Do I think what?
Would it resemble the system of Belarus if it moves?
I never thought about this possibility. I thought rather about the analogy... Thank you. I thought rather about the analogy with the Ukrainian electoral system, when one half of the parliamentary deputies were elected in single mandate constituencies and one half on party lists. I think that Mr. Plahotniuc will eventually climb down from his current position and agree to a mixed system on the Ukrainian model. And that, not for the sake of Mr. Plahotniuk's Democratic Party, which would almost certainly fail to enter parliament, but because of the Socialist Party. Because a mixed system in which one half of the parliamentary deputies are elected on party lists would benefit the Socialist Party of Mr. Dodon, by far the most popular party. And if Mr. Plahotniuc climbs down from the opening gambit to the next position, mixed system, then we would know, we would have further confirmation that there is an understanding between him and Mr. Dodon. And understanding with Mr. Dodon, not for Mr. Dodon's sake, but for Moscow's sake.
Andre.
Yes, could I have two questions? The first one, looks like you put in the center of your presentation the issue of capture of the state by one particular personality. Could you tell us anything about the commonality or difference in the of this capture of the state? You mentioned certainly internally, we're talking about internally captured state, like in Moldova by Plahotniuc, in Georgia by Ivanishvili, it's another business person. In Belarus by Lukashenko, he's not a business person, but looks like also captured the state.
Mm-hmm.
Also one person. Even case of Russia, we can also discuss by one person or by a group of people, but also captured state. So just not talking about the kind of the personnel personal feature, they're definitely different, but essentially about the institutions of the state, in all of, the, of those cases they are captured, is there any some kind of substantial difference in all those cases?
No.
It's one question. And the second question, looks like you mentioned that initially some kind of premature implementation of parliamentary system, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
If you can elaborate a little bit about this particular statement that you made, and maybe you can develop it in what we can now tell about the political transition in that part of the world after this 25 years or 27 years or whatever. Just maybe it's not only in this particular case in Moldova, maybe in some others, and maybe you have some other recommendations, what kind of political transition might be or should be based on the experience we have accumulated over the last, whatever, almost three decades.
Thank you. Regarding the cases of Georgia, Belarus, Russia, I would analyze this on a case-by-case basis. The analogy, the most obvious analogy is with Georgia. I used the concept of state capture in 2012 when Bizina Ivanishvili made his bid for full power in Georgia, 2012-2013. In my coverage of Georgia at that time, I made ample use of the concept of state capture to apply it to Mr. Ivanishvili. The analogies between Ivanishvili and Plahotniuc are obvious. No oligarch, Mr. Ivanishvili was mislabeled as an oligarch. He was a single player, by far the most powerful economic player in the country, both before and after his successful state capture. Mr. Ivanishvili did not, and I don't think he has to this day, espouse an ideology or a set of norms or a set of values. He sought power. So does Mr. Plahotniuc. No ideology, no set of norms. Both of them were and are highly skilled financial operators and political manipulators. And both instituted a system of personal power without constitutional or legal responsibility and without accountability. Ruling from backstage, controlling the government, micromanaging the government through their personal network of relationships and through the distribution of patronage. In the same way, Mr. Ivanishvili and Mr. Plahotniuc, a few years apart from each other, were able to rig elections. And I see a further analogy. The United States endorsed both of these cases of state capture. The US was involved in a whole series of regime change operations between 2000, since the early 2000s and 2015, under the Bush and Obama administrations, a whole series of regime change operations. I think the smoothest and most elegant one was the one in Georgia in 2012-2013. It succeeded in putting Mr. Ivanishvili in power over a staunch ally of the United States, Mikhail Saakashvili, and it did so in Georgia by carefully sent political signals. Mr. Saakashvili had elevated the United States into the main political arbiter of Georgia's domestic politics. Everyone in Georgia involved in competition for power looked at the United States as an arbiter of domestic politics. Mr. Saakashvili created that situation, and the US used that position in 2012-2013 through very clear but subtle signals in Georgia and in Washington to signal that it was time for Mr. Saakashvili to go and for Mr. Ivanishvili to come in. The most elegant, smoothest, and probably the only successful regime change operation of, by the United States during all this time. In Moldova, the US did not initiate the state capture by Mr. Plahotniuc. It was not initiated by the United States. The US found that situation almost as a fait accompli and endorsed it. in the ring of stability and with fairly high visibility. Victoria Nuland, as I mentioned earlier, was the main spokesman for U.S. policy in this regard. In the case of Mr. Lukashenko, I don't regard this as a case of state capture. Mr. Lukashenko does not have business interests of his own. If he does, they are very modest, I'm sure. There is no business political oligarchy in Belarus. Lukashenko has been in power and generally elected as an anti-establishment candidate as far back as 1994 and has been continuously in power. So his state capture, if it is a state capture, is of a completely different nature from Mr. Plahotniuk's or Mr. Ivanishvili's. And in Russia, of course, in Russia we had an oligarchic state capture in the 1990s until Mr. Putin subdued the oligarchs. To the second question about the premature introduction of the parliamentary system of government. Except for the Baltic states, it was only in Moldova and in Ukraine that, and to some extent in Georgia, that Western countries encouraged the formation of a system of government based on parliamentary parties. I mentioned Georgia, I said to some extent. Mr. Saakashvili and his party came to power in 2003 as part of one of the color revolutions. But they instituted a system of government in Georgia that, in my view, was deserves the label of authoritarian reformism. Mr. Saakashvili instituted a vertical of power, which ensured the implementation of reforms in a swift and disciplined way. Mr. Saakashvili was, and his team, they were a team in a hurry. They felt that they could waste no time in pulling Georgia by its hair westwards. And they did so. They had a guaranteed parliamentary majority, constitutional majority, for, I think, 2 terms in office. And this continuity with a stable parliamentary majority, with a constitutional majority, it could guarantee long-term strategic planning, continuity of government, and it saved the government of Mr. Saakashvili from the coalition nightmare, what some call in Russian koalitsionny koshmar. And indeed, the many Georgian reformers who were recruited by the Ukrainian government after 2014 to push reforms in Ukraine based on the Georgian experience, they complained both publicly and to me personally, I know many of them, they complained that in the Ukrainian system of government by coalition, it is extremely difficult and extremely time-consuming to push through legislative initiatives and reforms, because so many interest groups have to be taken into account and negotiated with. Ukraine, well, every case is a special case. Ukraine is a special case in its own way because, among other reasons, Ukraine is traditionally a country with dispersed political authority and multiple centers of decision making. There is no one single authoritative center of power in Ukraine. Power is dispersed among interest groups, among parliamentary factions, among territory on a territorial basis. All this needs to be negotiated with. Ukraine is very special in this regard. It has a tradition of centrifugal tendencies and multiple centers of political and economic decision making. In Moldova, we didn't have this. In Georgia, we didn't have this. In Moldova, we don't have this. In Moldova, it was easier for Mr. Plahotniuk to accomplish what I think no Ukrainian leader could accomplish: centralized power in its own hands. Why was it premature in Moldova to introduce a parliamentary system of government? Because the institutions were lacking, the necessary mentalities were lacking. There were no genuine political parties in Moldova other than the Soviet legacy Communist Party, with a mass base and with mass appeal. And there was such a proliferation of small political parties in Moldova that their constant quarrels discredited the political, the parliamentary system. It drove the approval rating of parliament and of political parties as such to the bottom of public opinion polls. It created alienation bordering on disgust among voters, and it played into the hands first of the Communist Party, then of the Socialist Party, and then of Mr. Plahotniuc, who captured a very weak and vulnerable system. Unfortunately, on the other hand, I see almost no personality in Moldova that could have taken on the role of national leader to drive an authoritarian reformist government. There was no Mr. Saakashvili in Moldova. Mr. Vlad Filat could have played that role, perhaps. Saakashvili was the role model of Vlad Filat. Filat did not have the abilities of Saakashvili, but it aspired to emulate that model. But political authority was far too dispersed in Moldova, and Vlad Filat's party could never assemble a parliamentary majority in its own right. And it became the victim of Caesar's game or a salami game within the coalition government. Moldova was not prepared to sustain a parliamentary system or a party system. There is a contradiction, inherent contradiction, between reformism and the parliamentary party system. Ukraine might pull it off. It was unable to pull it off after the Orange Revolution. The Orange Revolution increased the chaos in Ukraine and in the Ukrainian government, and was a major setback to Ukraine's pro-Western orientation. And it triggered a boomerang effect. Shortly after the Orange Revolution, the Yanukovych government came to power. The second Yanukovych government came back to power. Ukraine now might pull it off. Ukraine. Today's Ukraine is not Ukraine of the Ukraine of 10 years ago or even of 5 years ago. It might pull it off, but slowly, painfully, perhaps abusing the patience of Western governments and Western donors, increasing the sentiment of Ukraine fatigue among governments and donors. But it might pull it off. In Moldova, I see nobody pulling it off. And indeed, the multi-party system in Moldova has died. It has died since 2014, when the parties elected to parliament in November 2014 have been broken up by Mr. Plahotniuc, who has assembled pieces of the former parties into a parliamentary majority of his own. So the multi-party system in Moldova is dead. We have a bipolar system. Mr. Plahotniuc's system group on one hand, and Mr. Dodon's Socialist Party on the other hand. It is a bipolar system. One party, the Socialists under Mr. Dodon, versus Mr. Plahotniuc's structure of power, not party of power, but structure of power. There is no more a multi-party system in Moldova.
Question here?
Chris, quick question. I'm Blake Murray from the U.S. Department of Commerce. I was interested in knowing a little bit about what the business climate is like in Moldova. Romania is a neighbor and very, very pro-U.S. businesses, multinational companies. What's it like for a business operating in Moldova under this political climate? Is it easy to open a business there? What's the ease of doing business for a foreign company in Moldova? If there is, are there any businesses operating there?
Yeah. The business climate. One of the reasons behind Moldova's economic failure is precisely the inability to attract foreign investment. Foreign investment was hoped for and was expected to come in as a result of the signing of Moldova's association agreement with the EU. And the foreign investment was expected to focus specifically, narrowly, on Moldova's agriculture. to make Moldova's agricultural products marketable in the West by importing Western technologies and Western marketing know-how, because Moldovan agricultural producers have no marketing know-how. And product quality is, for the most part, not competitive on Western markets. It's barely competitive even on the Russian market. So the necessary investments would have been modest in amounts. Basically, the processing and marketing of agricultural products. But very few Western companies, almost none, came to Moldova because of the inhospitable investment climate, which begins with lack of independent courts, widespread corruption and bribery in the state apparatus, and dependence on Western investors upon informal sweetheart deals with representatives of the authorities. So Moldova's vast agricultural potential remains largely unexploited. The existing production, which is far below potential, remains non-competitive for lack of Western investment in this sector. There is one small German investment in a sugar beet operation, sugar beet cultivation in the sugar factory, a small German investment. But this does not make a difference at all in the overall picture. And as a result, Moldova is unable to use or to fill the import quotas that the European Union has granted to Moldova as part of the association agreement. Most of these Moldovan import quotas in the EU are not being filled. On the non-agricultural side, Romania is now trying, for the first time since 1991, Romania is aspiring to privatize Moldovan state assets. The state assets up for privatization include Moldovan Railroad, the Moldovan State Telecommunications Company, Moldovan tobacco plant, large capacity tobacco plant in Chisinau, and some, what else? Yes, and two out of the five electricity distribution networks, one of which has already been privatized by the Spanish company Union Fenosa, now known as Gas Fenosa. So Romania might be able to enter the Moldovan state assets market, and if so, protect these assets against a Russian takeover, which in my view would be a very positive development if it materializes.
You had a question?
Yes, Mr. Sokol, thank you so much
for your
presentation. It was very interesting. My name is Bogdan Pintilia. I'm with the Embassy of Romania. I found your presentation very interesting. I enjoyed your dragon metaphor. Just a quick question, and if you addressed it while I was away of the room, apologies. How durable do you see this situational partnership between Vlad and Ido Dodon? Because in the end, Dodon came from the same party that Mr. Lupu came. Dodon was instrumental in electing the president in 2011, in January 2011. Without his vote, this would have never happened. So I just want to hear your opinion on that, because you've been talking a lot about this partnership. And of course, with a view to the 2018 elections, which happened in the year when Romania celebrates 100 years since the unifications of the provinces and all of that.
To explain to the audience, you mentioned the event that you mentioned in 2011, the election of a Moldovan head of state in parliament. Moldova is a parliamentary republic. It elects the head of state in parliament. For more than 2 years, Moldova did not have a head of state because the parliament was unable to muster the necessary majority for electing the president.
And
that
was okay.
Sorry?
And they survived.
Yeah. And it was only in 2012 that Mr. Plahotniuc induced Mr. Dodon, who at the time controlled only three seats in the Moldovan parliament, to cast those three votes in favor of electing a head of state, which was done. Now, that was 2012. It was a time, a period, which extended from 2009 until 2014, when the Moldovan parliament was so fragmented. It was an arena of a struggle of all against all. And any initiative, any legislation, any major decision required making a situational alliance that lasted temporarily for the duration of that vote. It was a Hobbesian war against by all against all among these numerous political parties in parliament. This situation also contributed to a voter backlash against the parliamentary system and to the migration of voters to Mr. Dodon in disgust with this constant chaos in parliament. Now, in 2012, when Mr. Dodon contributed his three votes to electing a head of state, regardless of whom, a head of state had to be elected. The person was Nicolae Timofti, whose presidential term ended in a few months ago, half a year after the expiration of its official term. He was, I would say, he fit the Russian stereotype, the old traditional Russian-Soviet stereotype of a Moldovan. Docile, quiet, non-assertive, submissive. He was a 65 or 70 years old former Soviet era judge who allowed the political leaders, and first and foremost Mr. Blagodnyuk, to do whatever they pleased without uttering a sound. That's why he was selected. He was selected by politicians at that time. When he was selected in 2012, the coalition government was still balanced, relatively balanced, between the competing parties of Mr. Plahotniuc and Mr. Filat. So they together decided to appoint this colorless, silent, passive, docile figure as head of state. But after 2012, Mr. Plahotniuc rapidly increased his power at the expense of the other coalition parties, first and foremost of Vlad Filat, who ended up in jail on obviously trumped up charges in October, since October 2015. So the vote of 2012 was one of those many situational alliances made inevitable in a deeply fragmented, pulverized parliament, as we have known for many years in the Ukrainian parliament, which was also characterized for many years by situational alliances that are changing in a kaleidoscopical fashion. You turn the kaleidoscope by a few degrees and the whole configuration changes. This is when the parliamentary system of government is introduced prematurely in a country that is not prepared for it. Does this answer the question?
The durability of the partnership.
The
elections, upcoming elections, which have a huge stake for both sides.
Yeah. The question is how durable is Mr. Plahotniuc's partnership with Mr. Dodon? Again, it is a situational partnership. It is far from a full partnership. It is a highly selective partnership. It is an issue-by-issue partnership. We see evidence of it step by step as political processes unfold. It is not a continuous partnership, it is not a uniform partnership, it is a partnership marked by a great deal of antagonism and competitiveness. They are rivals. But they are rivals who can cooperate from time to time on selective issues. And I mentioned those issues, how they apportioned among themselves the television channels, how they apportioned among themselves the posts of Gazprom Moldova head and Chisinau Gaz head. And above all, how Mr. Plahotniuc lifted Mr. Dodon over the 50% threshold to win the presidential runoff. That was the biggest present that Mr. Plahotniuc made to Moscow. And incidentally, speaking of the Romania, Mr. Dodon is not only pro-Russian, he's a Romanophobic president. He despises Romania. He promotes, in a very shrill and vulgar way, he promotes the so-called Moldovanism as opposed to Romanianism. Now, Mr. Plahotniuc has a situational partnership with Romania, too. But he did not hesitate to get Mr. Dodon elected as president, a Romanophobic president. This shows you, demonstrates, the flexibility, the high flexibility of Mr. Plahotniuc as a political operator, how he juggles with situational partnerships on a temporary basis. He is a master tactician, and he relies on surprise. Most of his decisions, most of his twists and turns, rely on surprising his competitors. And by the way, he has very competent political advisors. He has a highly expensive political apparatus of advisors, of consultants, of public relations specialists, of bloggers, and of trolls. It is an expensive apparatus to maintain. He maintains this apparatus, he and his team. I should not reduce this to his personality. He and his team maintain this personality by recycling business revenue into political investments. He has made an enormous political investment in all this political apparatus. This political apparatus enables Mr. Plahotniuc to maintain political and personal control over business affairs. And a part of that revenue he recycles as a political investment. Nobody knows, by the way, where Mr. Plahotniuc's most of his capitals are invested. He does not have fixed capital investments in Moldova. He has few capital investments. He has a few hotels. In Moldova, he has a few hotels and a couple of office buildings. But where his most of his assets are invested, nobody knows. Maybe in offshores.
Human trafficking?
There are many allegations of human trafficking about Plahotniuc. I have not seen the evidence. I would not venture to say that he is involved in human trafficking. I know about the allegations. The allegations are all over the media. But personally, I have not seen evidence of that.
It's not big money.
Sorry?
It's not big money.
It's not big money.
It's not big money, yes. It should be somewhere else.
Mm. Yeah, it should be somewhere. More likely in offshores. During this entire period, Mr. Plahotniuc controlled, as I said, since 2010. He controlled all the regulatory agencies, including, and the law enforcement agencies, including the financial regulatory agencies, including the Moldovan National Bank. And nobody knows how and when the $1 billion was stolen, and nobody knows how and when the $22 billion were laundered from Russia via Moldova to Western countries. And there's an asterisk here, in this context. The asterisk is that while Russia is trying to investigate where the alleged $22 billion went, there is no known attempt in the West to investigate where the $22 billion went. Most of them went to the West. We know this for sure. To various banks in Britain, in Western offshores, in Britain most of all, including Scotland, and in various Western offshores and in Cyprus. But there is no known attempt by the West, in the West, to investigate. Because after all, the money went into Western banks. It went from Russia into Western banks. And the Russian investigation, which is ongoing since 2015, I think, maybe 16, I'm sure that it is a selective investigation. I'm sure that it does not try to discover all of the perpetrators in Russia, but only some of them selectively.
Okay. Well, I think we need to wrap it up. Vlad has to head to the airport. You've been with us almost 2 hours. I think you've had a very exhaustive analysis of Moldova and the internal politics of a geopolitics of a captured state. So thank you for coming, and we'll try to have a write-up on this and send it out afterwards, and maybe even post the talk on the web. So thank you very much for coming. See you again soon.
Thank you.